Hello.
Hello there.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. How about you?
Not too bad. Just settling in on this Monday night here. It's a little chilly here in New England.
Hey, same here. It's dropping to the low 50s and starting to rain in Wisconsin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Nice to finally chat.
Yeah. I've been seeing your stuff all over the place past couple months, and I really like the layout of the website and everything. It just looks really cool. It's very sleek.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
I actually was just showing my oldest daughter. We were just watching On the Trail of Champ.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, fantastic. But
thank you.
Series, by the way.
Yeah, it was just amazing being able to work on that, and it was awesome being part of the Small Town Monsters name, of course.
It's just how did it feel? Like, you know, you got those big, them big names, you know, cryptids, to like do something with that, like with Champ.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Oh, it was cool. I mean, I felt like Champ had never really had its own sort of series. I don't know. I'd seen a lot of documentaries on Champ, and sure, there were, you know, Discovery Channel programs. There's Monster Quest. They did like individual episodes on Champ, but I feel like a lot of the documentaries were about like lake monsters in general. So they would do Loch Ness, Ogopogo, Champ, something else, all in one episode.
Right.
So Champ was kind of like a sideline show. And I personally think Champ is one of the more fascinating of all of the lake cryptids. I mean, obviously I'm biased having, you know, worked on Champ in detail, but I think it's really interesting. And I think it truly does get the, deserve the title of America's Loch Ness Monster.
Oh, for sure. The one thing that, like you said, they usually do like the combined Loch Ness, Ogopogo, Champ, all that, but the thing I think that sets Champ apart is the Mansi photograph.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Just, there's something about, I remember seeing that as a kid. There's just something about it that is so, I guess, emotional when you see it. Like, wow, there actually is something there.
Yeah. It's I don't know. I'm getting a little bit of echo. Should I put some headphones on or? Or is that okay? It seems like it's going away now. Okay.
Yeah, I think I just kind of had my volume turned up a little bit too loud.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, so the Mansi photo, I mean, it's just, you know, like, I'm sure just like you, when I was a kid, I saw that, and, you know, it's just very, it's like, wow. It's like this the surgeon's photo of Loch Ness, but since that has sort of been, you know, relegated into the hoax bin, which, you know, it kind of, I think, rightfully belongs there. The Mansi photo obviously has not. And I think that's what's really compelling about it. It's just, it is considered like the gold standard of lake monsters. Like it is the Patterson-Gimlin, you know, frame where the, you know, the Sasquatch is moving its hand. It's that frame. It's, you know, that image for lake monsters, I think, without a doubt.
Oh,
and
for
it
sure.
Really, and it has that draw. And it's just so cool. And being able to talk to Sandra, and being one of the last people to talk with her, you know, fortunately, I was really glad to be able to interview her, you know, before she passed away, sadly, this past spring. But man, it's just hearing the backstory and everything she kind of felt about the photo and why she donated it to the people of Vermont as kind of like a public heirloom sort of thing was really interesting. It was really fascinating. I think that's a pretty cool chapter. Yeah, it's one of the most important chapters probably of the Champ mystery is the Mansi photo. It had such an impact. So, you know, it was not, you couldn't do a Champ documentary or series without talking about that.
For sure. Like there's just some about it. Like when you look at the surgeon's photo, you know, it's got that classic depiction of, you know, a side profile of a prehistoric creature or anything that encompasses that view when you think of a sea serpent or a lake monster. But this one, it's hard to think that someone would fake it or that would doctor a photo in a way that showed a creature in what appears to be like mid-turn.
Right.
Or like side profile. It's just one of those things that you're like, if someone were to do it, why would they choose that like of course, that profile.
Very elaborate on that sort of way. I mean, that's really, that would have been quite a feat to do. I mean, especially in the 70s, of course. You know, now I think maybe it might be a little easier, but, you know, not to say that you couldn't do it, but I'm pretty sure it's been established that, you know, whatever was in the photo was actually there. So they, you know, they were at least able to conclude, I think, after, because the photo was taken in 77, and then Sandra kind of and her family had it hidden for a little bit. They kind of just put it to the side. It was like in a family photo album, and it didn't actually break until the early 80s. That's when it was like on the New York Times, and it was like a, you know, it got national attention, and then it was in the spotlight. And then they started doing analysis on it, but they didn't have the negative, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah, which you know, would have, I guess, helped in a lot of situations. But I guess, like Sandra had told me, she said at that time, you know, we didn't keep the negatives of the photos because we had, you know, hundreds of family photos and that kind of thing. So I guess that explanation makes sense. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, it's a long time ago. I'm a millennial, so I'm more of the digital age. So I don't really know that much about the negatives and that sort of thing. So we'll leave that to the experts. But they were able to do some digital testing on it, rather, and figure out that it wasn't like tampered with as in the photo, you know, like we would say today that it was photoshopped or it was digitally enhanced. I guess it was actually, the object was truly in the water, but that's where the question arises, you know, how big was it? What was the scale? She couldn't remember exactly where it was taken. So the researchers have been trying to figure that out for, you know, a couple decades now since it was taken, and that might help determine what it was. And, you know, we've got various theories about what it could have been, as opposed to a lake monster. And then, of course, there's the theories that it could be a lake monster.
Right. I definitely see where she's coming from about, you know, not keeping the negatives, because I remember my mom, they have a cabinet in their house that's just filled with envelopes of photos. And when we used to get them, the negatives would always either just be tossed or, you know, just thrown in the back of a drawer. They weren't something you thought of because, oh, we got all our photos. Don't need these, not going to do with anything with them later on anyway. So, you know, it was just that mindset. You're just a normal person. You're not looking for fame with just a regular photo. So you don't think to keep it. So I can see that as, I'd probably do the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, obviously some people argue, oh, it was, you know, if they claimed that it was such an interesting or unique photo, why would they throw away the negative? But I think at the time they didn't really understand what it was, at least from what I interpreted from what Sandra had said. You know, they didn't really know what to make of it, kind of thing. They were, I think, more confused than anything. And then when the actual media frenzy around it kind of took off, did they realize how significant it was? And, you know, that's obviously giving her, you know, the good faith that, you know, there's no funny business about it, which I don't think, if it was a hoax or something like that, I don't think that Sandra Mansi had anything to do with that. And like I said, that's kind of, if it was, then I think it was something external aside from her and her immediate family that pulled that.
Right. From all the, you know, interviews and documentaries and stuff I've seen her on, she always seemed like a extremely genuine person. I don't see her having anything to do with it. If it was outside forces, people set something up, and she could have just got wrapped up into it.
Right. That's I mean, what I would say as well, because I think that she obviously had nothing to do with it. You know, at the same time, it is interesting that nobody else had a similar kind of thing happen. I mean, if someone did take the time and effort to put such an elaborate hoax together, why would they pick, you know, such a secluded spot? You know, I've been to that part of the lake, and it's really, I mean, that's why she doesn't remember where it was, I think, is because it was one of these random bays and inlets. Right. Cause there's so many of them. It wasn't like a particularly, you know, well-known spot. I mean, there's plenty of spots on the lake in Burlington, Vermont, other parts of the lake where you could go and hundreds of people would see it. And, you know, I think, you know, if you were doing a prank or a hoax, maybe that would make it more visible or more known, the fact that only one person saw it. And then, you know, you've got theories like Benjamin Radford's theory that it was some sort of a strange shaped log.
I've heard that one a lot, with the animation of it spinning and.
Yeah. Yeah. And I talked about that in the series. You know, I talked to Ben and I got his thoughts on it, because I really wanted to I wanted to first, talk to Sandra, have her tell her story. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to interview her in person, but the phone was the next best thing, given her, she had a lot of health issues in the last year of her life. But I wanted to talk to Ben and some of the other people as well that had been doing research on it. And, his conclusion was that it was some sort of a log, which is plausible. I mean, it does happen that there are strange logs like that can get propelled. I mean, there's other photos in the lake that have happened, and similar logs have been found, things like that. So, it's not implausible. I think personally, after talking to Sandra, that it was much more animated than I think a log. So I don't really know what to make of it, to kind of conclude with that. But it's, right. It was very interesting. I can't, because I'm obviously on the fence about Champ. I, as the filmmaker, you have to be sort of play devil's advocate, and I want to get both sides, and I want to portray sort of all of the theories and opinions, and I don't really want to stick in one camp or try and prove or disprove. I just want to lay out all the information and let people make up their own mind ultimately.
For sure. So what do you think it is?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's a tough one. My personal favorite theory, and I'm not giving credence to this 100%. I'm just saying I like this more than the plesiosaur theory, or it's all just a hoax. I think it's some sort of a giant turtle or a large unknown species of turtle that has a long neck. I think there's actually, if you look at a lot of even smaller turtles, when they extend their neck, it can be pretty long. And there's some interesting footage taken, I think in 2007. Have it in the documentary as well, the Olsen footage, where you can see sort of this creature swimming, and it almost changes its neck a couple times. It has a smaller head, then it has a longer neck, and I mean that would be something that maybe a turtle could do. And I know there's some people who are proponents of that theory, and I think that's personally maybe the most plausible. It would maybe explain why you don't see these things as much, because they're more turtles can be under the water most of the time. They can actually breathe through their skin in some cases and have more of amphibious sort of things going on with them. So I think that's an interesting theory, but I don't think 100% that's the case, but that's my personal favorite theory.
See, when it because I have random people ask me this all the time, because one of my favorite things to research primarily in Wisconsin is lake monsters and river monsters and all that. And I don't know what most of them are, because they vary depending on which county you're on. They can be anything from, a giant turtle to a serpent to a dinosaur looking thing. But I've always been a fan of the theory of a giant mollusk.
Oh, interesting.
I haven't seen a lot about it. I've come across a few, articles on it from different people, but the theory is that it's a giant mollusk that primarily lives, in the sediment underneath oceans, rivers, lakes, wherever, various species, depending on what body of water you're in. But that it primarily buries itself when it needs to feed on surface dwelling, plankton, plants, bacteria, whatever it's eating. It comes up, it's got its arm, kind of like a clam, when it, scoops around for whatever it's eaten. And that's what people are seeing on the surface, looking like a neck with a bulbous body behind it, which would be maybe a shell or some sort of hard, skin type. And then when it gets what it needs, it kind of releases all that air it sucked in, kind of like a fish bladder, and sinks back down and buries itself back on the floor.
Very interesting. I mean, I think anything goes at this point. It's between that
pretty and much
that,
yeah,
there's it's anyone's guess. I think it's interesting that it kind of reminds me of the theory that some of the old time Loch Ness theories were about. There was this ancient organism that had these kind of limbs. It wasn't, I don't exactly remember the term of the creature, but it's just these little things that were a couple feet long that lived.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
And then some people are saying, oh, maybe that's sort of what the Loch Ness and some of these lake monsters are. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's so many lake monsters out there. You know, I'm just doing a bunch of research now for a presentation I'm doing this Friday here in New England about kind of New England cryptids. And, you know, Champ is obviously the most famous lake monster in the area, but there's a couple of other ones which are interesting, which I think can be explained in more, dare I say, conventional methods.
Right.
You know, they're either, you know, like there's a lake in northern Vermont in Canada called Lake Memphremagog, which has, you know, Memphrey, which is this creature seen, which, you know, generally is kind of described more as like a large type fish or an eel or something. So it's not exactly the more dinosaur-like portrayal. So that's probably more of what it is than like a plesiosaur type creature. And then there's another one also in Vermont, Lake Willoughby, which, you know, it's literally described as like a giant eel. So
yeah,
that's, I think, more conventional, but still, you know, you can have monsters that are, you know, sturgeon that are like 7-8 feet long. I mean, by definition, you see that thing pop up next to you in the water, that's a monster.
For sure. Like the giant fish, it brings to mind in Alaska, I believe it's Lake Lilanu.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, the giant silver fish that were spotted from, you know, up in a helicopter, kind of like the size of whales.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have a map here, actually, I got at the cryptozoology conference back in September that was drawn by what's the lady's name? She had a booth there, but it's this cool map. It's got like North American cryptids. It's got all the main ones. And then way up in Alaska, it's Lake Iliamna. It's like a giant sturgeon type thing. It just looks really cool.
And it's like, that's when you start talking about that stuff, that's where, you know, those unfamiliar with cryptozoology start kind of zoning out or start becoming more interested, because it's kind of like, well, wait a minute, I thought this was just monsters, surviving dinosaurs, you know, beasts, dragons, whatever you want to call them. But you're just describing like a giant fish or a giant eel. And it's like, yes, that's what it is. We don't know what these giant fish or giant eels are.
Oh, absolutely.
They're not discovered. So
yeah, that's
what people are looking for.
Something I kind of like about cryptozoology is the fact that, you know, I try and kind of, when I talk about it, I do the more classical definition. I'll talk about, you know, animals like the coelacanth, the okapi, the gorilla, some of these creatures which technically were cryptids until they were discovered, you know, in a similar sort of way. You know, in Central Africa, in the mountains, they talked about seeing hairy man-like creatures, you know, the natives and the locals, and, you know, turned out to be, you know, one of our closest relatives in, you know, the chimpanzees and the gorillas and whatever.
Right.
But it's really interesting. Like the next project I'm doing right now, which I haven't really talked about online that much, but I guess I'm sort of breaking a little bit on it, is about mountain lions and actually like felines and kind of mystery cat sightings in the Northeast.
Nice.
And that's the thing which is more, you know, I think it blends cryptozoology and regular biology, because, you know, it's a phenomena of animals that used to exist in this area that are being sighted here once again. We've had even specimens that have been killed, like in Connecticut back in 2011, a mountain lion was run over. I mean, this was like 40, 50 miles outside of New York City, very close, in a suburban part of Connecticut on the coast, was hit by a car, and it had a tracking kind of tag on it that it had come all the way from North Dakota to Connecticut. So
yeah, we're getting those in Wisconsin. We're getting a lot of big cats that are starting to make their way back. And about last year, not too far from where I live, probably only like 10 minutes away, people were saying, hey, we're finding these tracks. They look like cougar tracks. So, you know, the DNR is coming out. They're like, no, this is not a cougar. This is, you know, this is something else. This is, you know, a large house cat got out, snow melted, prints look bigger than what they are. People keep going on, we're seeing this thing. You're telling us we're not seeing it, but we are. Like, one ran in front of the road. I saw one out my back door. DNR kept saying, no, that you're not seeing it. Big cats aren't in the state anymore. They moved out years ago. And then it took, you know, a trail cam photo and then a security camera that someone had on their house to prove that these things. And then, you know, finally DNR was like, oh, okay, I guess we were wrong. They have moved back in the state. So the big cat phenomenon is, it's crazy to like witness it slowly spreading all over, because the cats are definitely making their way back to the areas they once had. And for people to deny that, it's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm actually just looking at a map right now, which this is a site. I mean, it sound the name of the website might be funny. It's called cougarnetwork.org. Cougarnet.org. I know it's got like a bad connotation, but it's a site about researchers, and it actually has an entire page dedicated to contact information with wildlife officials in the states that, you know, they have like a Midwest contact page. They have New England, Northeast. They have like the South, and it has a map which has conformations map, which is really interesting, and it shows the current range of the, you know, the cougars, the mountain lions, which is, you know, the Rocky Mountains and west of there into Canada, British Columbia, that sort of area. And, you know, in the eastern part of the U.S., you have in the Midwest, and then leading up into the east, you have, you know, dozens of conformations. And obviously you guys are closer to their current range, so you'd obviously have more than we would in New England. But I know of so many sightings that happen in New England, and the debate around here and in the Northeast in general is, oh, are these mountain lions that are making their way back, or are they pets that are being released? I guess there's that debate as well.
Right.
Some people still argue that maybe the eastern cougar, which was the subspecies of the mountain lions, actually never went extinct. And, you know, even though they were pretty much hunted to extinction in all of the northeastern states, and, you know, like the 1910s were some of the last times, you know, they had killed cougars, and a lot of them are mounted in like museums now. But I'm looking at like Wisconsin in particular, and there's like, here, let's see, there's 46 showing up here. Brown County, Wisconsin, confirmation number 369. There's a photo. There's it's all kinds of stuff. It's a really interesting website. It's like a very informative thing if you're more interested in that kind of stuff. But
yeah, I'll definitely have to check that out.
Yeah, because you guys are definitely in a hot spot right there.
I remember when it was going on. Like people were, they weren't letting their dogs out at night. They weren't letting their kids walk to school if they were through a more wooded areas, just because. You know, someone says there's a big cat on the loose, people are like, oh, you know, what kind of cat are we talking about? But someone says, hey, we think there might be a mountain lion around here, people start, you know, freaking out a little bit. Like, we've never dealt with a mountain lion before. Close.
Yeah. I mean, I can only imagine. It's, I've heard of cases around here as well, where there were, you know, animals reported killed and attacked, and, you know, people never figured out what it was, but a lot of people are saying it was a mountain lion, things like that. But like I was kind of saying, it's bringing in sort of cryptozoology, which I guess is, you know, unfortunately widely disregarded by most serious kind of scientists as being, you know, pseudoscience or whatever, because people think, oh, you know, cryptozoology is Bigfoot, it's the Mothman, it's things like that. You know, like, for example, in my presentation I'm doing on the New England cryptids, you know, I'm not saying any of them are real or not. I'm simply talking about cases. So, you know, I have the Dover Demon in there along with Pukwudgies and then mountain lions. So I think that's probably going to throw some people off, because right. They're going to be like, okay, you know, they'll think it's more legit, I guess, if it's, you know, also wolves, gray wolves are something that, you know, technically is a cryptid around here, because they are sighted. There's been specimens killed, but the known population are, you know, above the St. Lawrence River in Canada. So the theory is that they are coming down into the eastern part of the country from, you know, their known range. So it's interesting. And I've even heard talk about, you know, secret reintroduction programs, like trying to bring mountain lions and other animals back into these areas, and how, you know, if it was not exactly being done, you know, and it's done in a secretive way so that it doesn't spark outrage. I mean, I don't know how true that is, but I find that interesting. Hopefully I can cover that in the project I'm going to be doing on mountain lions.
I've actually heard that too. And I was, a few years ago, I was actually reading, about the thylacine. There was that secret reintroduction program that they were trying to, I can't remember if they were smuggling them or if they were holding them in Australia away from poachers. And, you know, when the order was kill on site for, you know, a bounty on them. I can't remember the group that was doing it, but I could definitely see that, you know, people wanting to bring animals back into the lands that, you know, they used to claim as their own, and people raising these, you know, babies up until they're old enough to take care of themselves and just letting them go back out there. I can definitely see, you know, certain groups of people doing that.
I mean, that's something I had not even thought of until I started doing research for this project. You know, it makes sense, I think, in a state like Colorado or Utah, right? There's obviously population density is a lot less than states on the East Coast. So you can imagine, you know, in New York State, maybe New Jersey, trying to reintroduce something like a mountain lion, there'd be a lot greater risk, and there'd probably be a much larger public outcry against something like that. So that's something that's really interesting. And I really hope I can get some information. I mean, I'm supposed to talk to, you know, state wildlife officials who, you know, of course the states will probably tell you, you know, they don't recognize the fact that there are mountain lions here because they don't have the hard evidence. You know, they're saying, oh, they're just passing through, things like that. So it'll be interesting to see exactly what they can say. But this whole secret kind of introduction, I think, is a definitely an avenue I want to pursue.
It'd be awesome if you started going down that, you know, that path and you ended up cracking some like big underground animal reintroduction program that no one's ever heard of before.
Oh yeah. Bringing in, you know, conspiracy theory full circle, kind of bring in the government sort of aspect.
Give your presentation. You have to hand out tinfoil hats right away.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I'm hoping that'll be, you know, documentary. I'm tentatively titling it Lions of the East, and we'll see, you know, or Lions of the Northeast rather.
But nice.
I just, you know, I'm sort of staying away from the mystery big cat in the sense of the black panthers and the.
I was just going to ask that.
Yeah, I think that's a topic unto itself. I think it's connected in a way. I don't think it's going to go without mention, but I feel like that's an entirely separate topic that, you know, I definitely would like to look at perhaps in the future, you know.
Right.
I have no idea if I will or not, but that's something for sure that would be interesting. But this is more, you know, trying to talk to people who have had the sightings because, you know, I've talked to people who have had, I think, credible sightings. You know, some people I've known for a while and in this area, you know, they have had experiences that, you know, would indicate that there's either some sort of population or they're just moving back. And like I said, there's been documented evidence that at least individuals have traveled all the way from North Dakota to Connecticut and, you know, other parts of the East Coast. So it is very interesting.
Do you feel that people are more willing to chat about their experiences if it involves, you know, a known species? Like you say, big cat. We got mountain lions, we got, you know, pumas, cougars, all that, which are, I guess, technically some of them have the same names for the same species. But yeah. Do you feel they're more willing to chat about something like that rather than, hey, I'm looking for people who have seen a sea serpent, come talk and we're going to put you on camera, or we're going to get your information. Is there like a big line drawn there?
I think so. Yeah, I think definitely. It's easier to get people who have had experiences with mountain lions. You know, this is an established species that exists, that once existed in this area. So I'd say it's a little less far-fetched perhaps than something like an unidentified hominid or, you know, Bigfoot kind of creature that existing under our noses. It's something that people can kind of believe. And I think people who are not even aware of cryptozoology or any of this kind of stuff, you know, are aware of this phenomena. So I think that's why it has a little bit more of an appeal. You know, while you do bring cryptozoology into it, and I want to look at individual cases as well where, you know, like the Beast of Truro, for example, is a good example where people were, you know, animals were getting killed by some kind of a feline-like creature and it was never discovered what it was. Some people thought it was a mountain lion, you know, and that's where you bring sort of the cryptozoology side into it and talk to the experts and whatnot. But yeah, I'd say it is easier to get people to talk about a conventional species as opposed to something like a Bigfoot. Although I will say, it's not very difficult to get people, for example, at Lake Champlain to talk about Champ.
I mean, I could be
up to anyone and just ask them. And, you know, usually if they're a local, they've either heard of it. And I was actually surprised at how many people I would just randomly chat up with who would say, oh, yeah, you know, my father had an experience or, you know, oh, I think it's in there. You know, I believe in it because it's sort of a local legend sort of thing. I guess it depends where you're going and what you're talking about.
It's definitely that like hometown, home state cryptid pride that that's what they're known for. That's what they're more than willing to talk about.
Yeah, it, in a way it is. But then at the same time, like, for example, Lake Champlain, because it's such a massive lake, there are so many communities that surround it. So, you know, Champ is known, but it's not nearly anywhere near the levels that Loch Ness is, where the, one of the main reasons why people go to Loch Ness is for the monster, right? It's a huge tourism draw. Lake Champlain, it, you know, most people don't go because of Champ. Most people go because, you know, of the world-class fishing, the water sports, all the boating, all sorts of stuff. And that, you know, Burlington, Vermont's a big city. There's a lot of camps and stuff on the side of the lake. A lot of different outdoors kind of opportunities, and it's just because it's such a huge lake, 120 something miles long, and it, you know, it's spans, you know, New York State and Vermont, so it's, you know, got two different sides. So, you know, Champ is more of a local thing. I think locals are more aware of it than perhaps most visitors that visit really don't know much about Champ, aside from people like ourselves who are, you know, cryptid fanatics. So we, of course, yeah, know all the stuff, and it's nice to talk to the locals then. But I do like the fact that most people don't know about Champ, because it almost creates like a sort of environment where if tourists and other people have a sighting, they have, you know, maybe never even heard of this. So why would they be projecting, you know, some sort of creature onto the lake if they're not even aware of it? And there's been a number of, you know, interesting sightings where, you know, upwards of 70 people on a cruise on Lake Champlain that had no idea about the monster had seen, you know, something swimming right next to their boat, and, you know, and then later learned about this legend that's been around. So it's interesting.
Right. When you say, like, you know, upwards of 70 people and stuff, it makes me, it reminds me of like the newspaper articles from, you know, decades ago, and how I wish that those were still written like that, where people, you know, you got a monster in your lake, you got some unknown thing walking through your forest, we're going to write article after article about it. And it's going to be right on the front page. We're going to give you all the facts. We're going to, you know, this is something everyone needs to know about. Now, you know, like you were saying, there's many people who just, they don't. It right under their nose. It, they have no idea what's going on because, you know, this stuff isn't taken quote unquote seriously anymore. But it's just something that people think is sadly a joke. And
yeah.
I blame, you know, reality TV and just pop culture in general, just muddying up the waters of people actually trying to make a difference and research, catalog, document all that. And it's just become, the people who like this stuff have just become like a caricature. It's disappointing.
It is, and that's reality TV. Especially as a filmmaker, it's frustrating because, you know, I always talk about this, but people, you know, I'm assuming you grew up in the same sort of way, watching these documentaries about this subject, and that's what got me into it, was seeing, you know, In Search of, the Discovery Channel, sort of the legit programs that weren't, you know, these reality TV drama sort of things that actually focused on the subject matter. And I think, unfortunately, we're so saturated with that stuff that, but, you know, at the same time, it is an opening for stuff like Small Town Monsters and other independent. To kind of bleed into the market, and there's a desire for it. And people want that reality without the reality TV aspect. They want the real sort of stuff. And I think, it, you know, you got to do it justice and cover it in that way. And, you know, talk about your point about the classic sort of cases back in like the 1800s. I mean, you read those and they're like amazing. You know, it doesn't matter what cryptid it is, what subject it is. It's always, you know, the classic cases of the wild man being seen, and there's the hunting party that goes out with 20 people. Or in Lake Champlain's case, there was this great serpent scare where, you know, like a steamboat almost hit the thing and capsized, and there were hunting parties being sent out because people thought it was eating their cattle. There was even P.T. Barnum offering a huge bounty on its head, and, you know, and then stuff like the Great New England Sea Serpent, some of the other sightings across the country as well. You've got these classic sort of stories, the Ape Canyon kind of stuff.
I've loved Ape Canyon, the Ape Canyon story, since I was a little kid. That's always been one of my top favorite ones.
I'd love to make it out to that area at some point. Just, you know, it's like history. And I love that, like the crypto tourism. You kind of, wherever I go, I try and find little, crypto kind of connections to be able to say, oh, I went there, this is kind of cool, you know, investigate it for yourself in a way. But Ape Canyon, that would be a heck of a place to check out.
I've heard they're making some headway on that, on finding the actual location of the cabin, because, you know, it was all buried due to, you know, Mount St. Helens erupting. But last I heard they were coming close to getting a general proximity of where the cabin was located by, like, finding nails and old shingles and stuff like that. So that would definitely be really cool if one day they actually did pinpoint, yes, this is where it was at.
That's so cool. That's like with the Patterson-Gimlin film. You know, there's people out there in that area of California that are investigating, trying to pin down exactly where the footage happened, you know, trying to find the trees, because the terrain has changed so much in those, you know, many decades since then. You know, their trees have fallen, there's been floods, washouts, whatever. So it changes, but they're trying to, you know, make headway and sort of market like a cryptid UNESCO kind of thing, you know, world heritage site or big. Oh.
Right. That's why I definitely like seeing these towns who embrace it and make a point to save it. Like Flatwoods, for example, the Flatwoods Monster, Rhinelander in Wisconsin embracing, you know, the Hodag. Straight up hoax. Everyone knows it's a hoax, but it's like, yeah, it's our hoax.
It's cool. Yeah, it's cool. It's unique. And everyone's seen that photo. I mean, I love that photo of the Hodag. And I know they got like the statue out there and that kind of thing. And then you got like Bray Road as well. I don't know how far that is from you, but I mean, I just got done watching the Seth's new movie on it. Oh my God. Like it's crazy. Like I want to go out there. I know it's a very like kind of non-descript sort of area, just sort of fields. And it just looks like a really cool area.
Yeah. It's about 10, 15 minutes away from me. And I actually found myself on the road, not even knowing I was on it, because it's just, you know, an everyday back farm country road. There's nothing special about it. But then all of a sudden you catch a glimpse of the street sign as you're passing by, and you're like, wait a minute, this is the spot. And I remember when I saw it, you know, I was coming back with my wife and kids, and I instantly had to start, you know, getting into that excited mode when one of your topics that you're passionate about comes up, and I had to go through the history of it. And this is where, you know, the car was scratched, and this is where the kids were chased out of the cornfield, and this is where, and by the time I knew it, we were already off the road driving back. So it's like these little areas have so much meaning behind them. So yeah, when you have these sites that are embrace it, it's definitely very, very cool.
It is. I mean, let me think a little bit of the Dover Demon, you know, which is, you know, I've just been reading Lauren Coleman's book about monsters in Massachusetts. And, you know, he obviously broke a lot of ground on the Dover Demon case in particular. And it's one of those things where it happened, you know, there were like three sightings, and it happened over the course of a couple of days. And that was it. It was a one kind of hit wonder, if you will. There was no other Dover Demon stuff, but it's still one of the most prolific kind of cases. And it's almost the opposite where, you know, the town there, they barely remember it. You know, there's nothing, there's no souvenirs, there's nothing of that. You know, it's a very, I actually work fairly close to where Dover is, Dover, Massachusetts. It's, you know, it's just kind of a wealthy little suburb of Boston where a lot of the, you know, people who work in the city live. And it's a very rural kind of town. You know, there's little just houses. But I remember last year I drove through it on the anniversary of when the sightings happened. You know, I found the road and everything. And I actually went to their public library and asked them, you know, if they had any details on the Dover Demon. And like, oh, you know, none of them really heard of it. Even some of the older kind of librarians, they're like, oh, I think I remember hearing about that back in the day. Or they said they went to school with one of the kids who had a sighting. And they actually pointed me to a book which had the town history of Dover. And they had a single page which had one of the sketches of the Dover Demon and kind of like a little one paragraph excerpt of it, and I got them to print it out, and I took it and I drove around to these spots. But it was unfortunate because it's like, you know, I went to a couple stores. I'm like, do you guys have any Dover Demon stuff? And, you know, nobody really knew about it. So it's almost like the cryptozoology community are the only ones who really know about the Dover Demon, aside from, you know, some locals in the area. But it's not like in these other parts, like Flatwoods, it seems like that's an actual like big tourist draw is Flatwoods, and they market in that way, and they have souvenirs and everything like that. So
I remember I actually just was watching I don't know if you've ever heard of the YouTube channel The Carpetbagger.
Not too familiar, no.
He essentially goes around, he does like roadside attractions, obscure museums, festivals, things like that. And he was actually just at the Flatwoods Monster festival. They started doing I think it's relatively new, but he was kind of doing a quick history of the background of it. I thought it was interesting that at first the town did not want anything to do with it.
Right.
They wanted to sweep it under the rug. They wanted to, they didn't want to associate themselves with that. But over time, they realized that this is a big interest. This is a big draw to people. Let's embrace it. Let's offer, you know, shirts. Let's offer a festival. Let's offer information when people come. Because, you know, when it comes down to it, these things bring in tourist dollars. They help, you know, keep the town alive. They bring in a source of revenue. And it all works together. So when you hear about these ones that they want nothing to do with it, and you have to go to, you know, online people in the cryptozoology community to get that information, it's kind of like there's a way to do it, to embrace it, but without jumping that line into crazy territory, you know,
right,
where it's just like you wish that there was just one department in every city and town that this is what they did. They were just appointed to document the weird stuff of the town, keep it all on file, because you know eventually someone's going to come down in a few years and ask about it. Just have it all ready.
That would be really good. And it's, you know, like you said, there's so many communities where the draw is the creature or the sighting. I mean, Willow Creek, you know, I was there a couple of years ago, and there's only one reason why I would ever go to Willow Creek. I mean, it's a very small town.
It was the Bigfoot Burger, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the Bigfoot Burger, exactly. Which was good. I had to try it. You know, that was one of the like three or four spots you have to hit when you go there. But you know, without the Bigfoot thing, like I don't know how people would really come in there on their own. And it's mostly people who are into the cryptozoology scene. And you know, with like Lake Champlain, you know, it depends. Most stores will have a little champ thing, and seems like there's some communities that are more reluctant to talk about it than others. And they're, you know, they had almost had its heyday like in the 80s or the 90s. And now they're kind of downplaying it. And they're saying, oh, you know, we're moving on to other sources of tourist revenue, which is too bad. But, you know, what can you do? I guess it's more for us cryptozoology fans to look into and kind of document then.
It sparked a memory when you said you don't know why like people would go through, you know, that town if it wasn't for the Bigfoot draw. And it reminded me of drawing a blank. It just reminded me of it, and my mind is already cleared on it. Charles E. Brown. He's a guy from Wisconsin that I like to talk about a lot. He worked at the State History Museum up in Madison. He did a lot of documenting on the legends of lake monsters in the state. He wanted to preserve the history of the state. He worked at the State Historical Society. He was also the secretary of the Wisconsin Archaeological Society. That's what I was trying to remember. But he pointed out a good thing. You know, you get all these places with these legends and stories and these draws for people. And these stories and stuff, while amazing to hear and people want to believe them, he made a statement where he said, regarding lake monsters, that a resort without a lake monster was behind the times. If you did not have a local monster, you weren't going to get people to come to you. Your resort was going to fail. Your town was going to fail. People were not even going to know you were there. They were not going to pass through your area. Mm-hmm. And it's cool to see that side of it. It's like, yes, there's these areas where people are like actually seeing something, but then you get these other ones that were created solely to bring people to them, and then over time they kind of got blended and mashed amongst like the real ones, and now people can't really separate the two from, you know, fact versus fiction. It's just one of those things. It's like you hear about a monster and then what is that the only reason this town is here? Would we know about this if it wasn't for, you know, Bigfoot or a Thunderbird or the Dover Demon or, you know, the Hodag, stuff like that. It's, the history behind it is a lot of times like much more interesting than the actual like story of the monster itself sometimes.
Oh yeah. Reminds me of a specific in Iceland where they have this, you know, Iceland's this beautiful country, huge tourist destination. It's blown up in the past couple of years, and they have this lake monster, I think, in the eastern part of the country. It was there a couple of years ago, and we drove past that area, and there wasn't really that much about it, but it's called like the Lagerflot worm. It's described as this like worm kind of monster. And
yeah, you know, I know the one you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. They tried a tourism initiative a couple of years ago where there was like a couple of pieces of footage that came out. And I guess the Icelandic government created like a government board that determined the authenticity of these videos as being authentic. And then they created like a whole website where you can report sightings, and they made these cool pamphlets that they put on the back of those maps that have like local business information, stuff like that. And it's a map of all the sightings and things like that. And I picked up a couple of those copies, and it's really cool. Yeah. Because it's sort of like a little off the beaten path area of Iceland. It's not a particularly, you know, stunning area. It's kind of like a silty glacial lake, you know, as compared to some of the other places in the country. So it's interesting how the lake monster, you know, of which there have been stories, I guess, for centuries, but it was really promoted a little bit by the government as a sort of tourism draw. And I don't think it exactly worked in that way, because most people still don't know much about it. And, you know, you ask people about it in the town, they kind of just smirk and giggle, you know, it's kind of a silly little thing, but it's cool. I don't know. It's just interesting to be able to find that stuff out and be able to travel those places and sort of look into it on your own.
Didn't that worm just recently, was that the one with the video which looked like, you know, a snake, an ice snake going through the lake?
Exactly.
Didn't that turn out to be like a piece of rope that was kind of frozen and the ice was disturbing the current of the lake passing around it?
I think that's what they speculated. Yeah, they were saying that because there was, I guess, two videos and they were from like the same farmer. And he was like, oh, you know, I was just out one morning and I see this thing swimming around. And it, you know, it doesn't seem to be really moving forward or backward, but you know, they, like I said, this government commission determined it was authentic, a real piece of footage. So I don't know. That kind of went with their little marketing plan, as I said, but right. Yeah, it didn't really look like it would be a biological creature. It looked more like something, you know, inanimate that was just kind of being moved around by the water, you know. But
it looked too good to be true.
Right.
When you
right.
saw it, it's like, nah, biological, you know, it's something does not move that uniform all the time. It's going to change it up. It's going to move in a way you wouldn't expect. It's not going to have that consistent pattern without a breaking point.
Right. Right. Yeah. That one's interesting because it connects to sort of like Norse mythology in that area that dates back a while. So that was kind of cool. But, you know, I don't really know what to think about that one. It's kind of a weird lake. I don't really imagine I don't think there's many fish living there. It's like super murky. It's like almost like a beige colored water because it's all glacial silt runoff from glaciers in the country. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it's just kind of over the years, legend kind of created itself and then took on to a different form and, you know, kind of they try to do a tourism thing, but who's to say, you know, who's to say maybe it's legit. I don't know. I mean, it's right. From what I've observed.
I like it when, these videos come out or these photographs come out, mostly of lake monsters. You know, a local news station might do a story on it, and they always start with, you know, according to legend, a creature has been living here for hundreds of years, and, you know, the Native Americans or the Vikings or, you know, European settlers encountered it, and then they go on to say, stories say that it's this big, and But the part that they always leave out is it's like stories also say that the thing used to like snatch livestock off and flip canoes and like eat sacrifices in order for people to cross the lake. It's kind of like, I want them to talk about that. Like a 2018 video comes out of this big thing snatching a bunch of cows off of the shore and just devouring them right then and there. And you're like, okay, this is the exact same one from legend. Maybe we should look into this and figure out what it is.
Right. Hunting to go after this thing, you know, they used to do. But that, you know, I think that's kind of the thing with some of the historical cases where, you know, maybe it was sort of, they embellished the story a little bit. And I think I read something about that, but the stories back in the day, you know, this was at a time where people were a lot more, I'd say, gullible, and, you know, there wasn't as many distractions, and, you know, they weren't living in the information age as we live in now. You know, although I think that's had a little bit of a, you know, reverse effect in a lot of cases, but, Yeah. So it's interesting back then, you know, people kind of, the newspapers were their only source of this information, so they might believe it more, and, you know, it creates like a hysteria, like, oh, there's this monster, it's attacking cows, we need to kill it, this and that. I mean, some of those Icelandic stories that were the historical cases, you know, describe the thing as like a couple miles long, and when it moved, it created earthquakes and tremors that shook up the local farms, and, you know, some of the old champ stories too. There were, like I said, the full-size steamboat almost hit the creature and nearly capsized, and, you know, there was it was being sighted in a cave devouring sheep and all kinds of stuff like that. It definitely seemed a little bit embellished.
Oh, for sure. I remember reading a while ago, you know, back at the time, a lot of these crazy newspaper stories would come out because it's always just like one story. Like for a lot of these, you know, smaller towns, it's just one story. They never talk about it again. And, you know, you're left scratching your head. What happened with it? You know, and looking into it, it's like, oh, back then, you know, many newspapers would hire freelance sensationalist writers. Just write the most crazy story you can think of. It'll bring in business. We'll get our money. You'll get paid. You can move on to the next one.
What was it like?
Alkali Lake Monster comes to mind. Because, you know, that was reported as a 40-foot long, dull gray, oversized alligator. It's living in this body of water. And when it came down to it, you know, people started looking into these legends where it said that history, there's tons of historical reports of seeing it, and there's, you know, Native American legends about it. But then when people started searching into it, it's like, no, there's not. There was no stories of this until this one newspaper article. Come to find out that, you know, a man by the name of, what was his name? John G. Mayer, or Marr, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but he was the mastermind who created it. He created the entire story, created the entire legend, and he did a few of these, you know, sensationalist articles. And that was his job, was essentially creating monsters for newspapers in order to bring in more revenue.
I mean, that's interesting. Directly reminds me, in the Lake Champlain case, you know, there's a, it's kind of like a revisionist history sort of thing where there was a, you know, a lot of people will cite the first sighting of Champ as being in the 1600s when Samuel de Champlain, who discovered the lake, you know, the first European to discover the lake, you know, was subsequently named after him. They claimed that he had a sighting of this, you know, enormous creature that was, you know, rumored by the natives to be, you know, this awful beast. And, you know, that story didn't appear until like the 1970s or something. There was a story in a Vermont magazine where an author talked about that. But from that point on, when that particular article was published, you know, that piece, little fact was thrown into the database, and that became established, so that many people said that Samuel de Champlain is the first person to have had a recorded sighting, you know, aside from the Native American lore. But the reality is what he actually described would fit more of what a long-nosed gar was, as in a fish. You know, he didn't describe it as being 20 feet long. It was, you know, 4 to 6 feet long with, you know, kind of the characteristics that a long-nosed gar, or, you know, kind of alligator gar type creature or type fish would have. So it's interesting how that little piece kind of was thrown into the database and threw a lot of people off, and unfortunately gets put out there as truth when it actually was basically thought of by somebody who saw this report that Samuel de Champlain had, and they sort of embellished it. And
that's what you have to spice it up a little bit.
Exactly. So that's what you got to worry about a lot of times in these sort of stories with whatever cryptid, how much of it is actually, somebody just creating this, or, it's folklore. So it's ultimately, maybe it's passed on orally from generation to generation. And, one little detail in a transfer from, a grandfather to a grandson, one little thing changes, but that could be a major detail. So that's something you have to worry about as well.
See, I think, I know we talked about it a little bit ago about how cryptozoology as a whole is kind of looked down upon by, other scientific bodies and a majority of people. But lately I have felt and still feel within the last few years, we're coming kind of into like a renaissance of it. There's more people who are taking it much more seriously and putting out, really thorough, really well-researched stories, documentaries, books, all that about these creatures, where people are starting to look at it with there might be something here. But along with that, I think we're also entering that new time frame of the sensationalist writing, simply because we've moved away from the newspapers, we've moved onto the internet now, and once someone puts it on the internet and two people share it, regardless of on YouTube, Facebook, Tumblr, wherever, if you have at least two people share it, it's going to go off like wildfire and people are going to automatically assume it's fact. And trying to break people of that is the hardest thing ever, because once people think it's fact and you try and tell them they're wrong, you're in the wrong. You're the bad guy.
Right. Yeah. You're just a skeptic, you're trying to just, destroy the legitimacy and make it all, fake and whatever. And I think that's the problem, because I see that a lot with the internet, social media and things like that. You'll have these obviously, fake stories, or you'll have like the same photo of like a mountain lion that gets used in multiple cases, or, that like that beast that came up, which was supposed to be like a dog man type thing recently. You probably saw that.
It's like the wolf standing on the side of the road and all that.
Yeah, and then there's the one out in Montana where it was supposedly like a bear that got killed, and it looked like a werewolf. So they're saying, "Oh, it's this creature from back in the day." And this story, it'll go viral, and it's the mainstream media will cover it. It'll be in kind of more tabloid sort of press and publication. Then it settles down. Then someone starts sharing it again on social media and some of these big Facebook groups, and then it blows up again. And it's like you've got people saying, "No, it was fake the first time. It's fake the second time," and it kind of has like a resurgence. And I feel like that happens a lot. And it's super sensational. Like just recently there was this Loch Ness thing that happened with, this photo that was supposedly taken from like a Google submarine or something that was in the lake they did a couple years ago.
I remember I posted about that not too long ago, where I gave my opinion on it, and I got a few messages where people were not happy about what I was saying.
Right. And that's what you're saying about the sensationalism, I think. And especially, there's so many websites, there's so many podcasts out now. I think people, if they want to get the more interesting story, they want to get the big scoop on something. And unfortunately, I think a lot of times the objectivity and like the actual scientific pursuit of the subject takes a backseat to that momentary sort of promotion or publicity, which kind of sucks, because I like you said, I think there is a resurgence still coming with cryptozoology. I think for a long time we had this reality TV stuff like we talked about earlier, but then there was also, the ghost and the UFO kind of fields. Those are getting kind of stale. There's so much, it's all the same kind of stuff. And then they almost kind of tried to co-opt cryptozoology, and you have the ghost and the UFO people coming into the Bigfoot and saying, "Oh, the Bigfoot is this and that," and into other areas of cryptozoology. there's a lot of people who will market themselves as like, they look into all that stuff, which, I personally don't have a problem with it. I consider myself, like an explorer of the 14 or the unknown. I consider the unknown to be anything from North Korea to, cryptids. I'm personally interested in the time, but I think there is sort of a callback to that golden era of cryptozoology that, Ivan T. Sanderson, the Lauren Coleman, the Four Horsemen of Bigfoot, that sort of classical age where it's almost like an Indiana Jones sort of thing you think of in your mind, you know, people trailblazing and looking for these creatures and, you know, the coelacanth and legitimate animals being part of that cryptozoology, not just these outlandish creatures like Pukwudgies or, you know, the Wendigo, which if you would even consider that a cryptid.
See, so I consider the Wendigo more of a, you know, just a classic Bigfoot type stories that have kind of taken on a life of their own. And, you know, it's like that collective consciousness where people have created a monster just by thinking of it. And it kind of got a life of its own and took off. All the legends always been there is exactly this. And it's like, no, I don't think it has in that sense. Yes, it has been in a way, but the way you're describing it is not the actual way you're thinking of something else, you know? That's my personal opinion on that.
Yeah, I find the Wendigo really interesting. Like, I will include that in my presentation on New England cryptids simply because, you know, I don't know if it's really a cryptid, but, you know, there's the whole Wendigo psychosis thing, and there's the whole, you know, aspect of that's like a supernatural kind of manifestation that happens when you're hungry and it turns people into cannibals. And there's the various descriptions of like the antler type creature. Then there's the more Bigfoot kind of thing. So I do consider it, you know, kind of in the cryptid category simply because there is sort of multiple interpretations. And I make sure to say that, you know, I make sure to make that clear that, you know, it's not really a cryptid sort of thing like a mountain lion would be, which is more grounded in reality. But it is interesting. You know, I think it's an interesting story, especially the Wendigo, which is so widespread. I mean, I know you guys have it in the northern Midwest, and it's very present in the New England area as well, in the northern parts and into Canada. So it's very fascinating.
Yeah, if you talk to some people here, they'll definitely talk about the Wendigo as if it is legitimately a creature, you know, a giant 7-8 foot tall, you know, really thin skeletal-like creature with, you know, horns and, you know, a deer skull or a moose skull, whatever. And like, they'll legitimately tell you as if they're talking about a real cryptid, not knowing that more what they're describing is more of the modern pop culture, you know, view of it. Whereas if they were really describing the actual, you know, cannibal Wendigo, it's more, you know, like icy veins and just a real thin person who literally just wants to eat people. like that's it. It's, and a lot of the times, you know, when people tell you, it's like you let them tell you, it's kind of like, okay, thank you for that. You know, you gave me a lot of good information, and then you just kind of move on because you don't want to, you know, sound rude or mean or hurt someone's feelings when you try and correct them on that. But
absolutely,
and it's happening so much more where people are getting their information from the wrong places, and it's just harder and harder to get solid, well-researched, actual facts on these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, especially with the Wendigo, what you're kind of saying, it's really interesting that, you know, there's the multiple kind of interpretations of it. But I think that, you know, unfortunately, people, they, maybe it's like an appropriation thing. And I think that happens a little bit with the Bigfoot stuff too, that, you know, that any sort of like Native American legend that remotely resembles something that might be Bigfoot in the modern sense is just co-opted and say, oh, it's definitely a Bigfoot legend. And, you know, it establishes the fact that all Native American tribes had it. But, you know, then at the same token, it's like a tribe that maybe has a legend about these giant hairy people has a legend about small hairy gnomes or little kind of like fairy-like creatures. So that doesn't exactly fit the bill. So that's sort of disregarded while you cherry pick the thing that kind of goes along with your own personal theory, your own personal bias. And, you know, that's just an example of confirmation bias. And like I said, kind of appropriating stories to fit your kind of premise or whatever your thesis is into a certain like cryptid like this.
I'm sure that you've probably seen it. If not, you more than likely will. Recently there's been that story going around of a young girl doing her homework. And like they claim that an angry male Sasquatch broke into the house and they got like the best photographic evidence of it. Have you seen this?
I think I've heard something about it. I They haven't presented a photo, have they?
They have presented a photo, and okay. I've been making the rounds disproving the photo, and I'll end up getting blocked from certain groups. Right. I'll end up getting, you know, angry comments, messages. But what it is someone took a picture of the Crookston, I believe that's how you pronounce it, the Crookston Bigfoot at, you know, International Cryptozoology Museum, added a blur to it, and put that as the true photo of this incident, and people are spreading it like wildfire. Oh, and I found, you know, the actual photo just through a quick Google search. I think it was on the second page, which shows the frame and everything. And people are saying, you're just a skeptic. Why are you here? You're just trying to, you know, insult people's beliefs. And it's like, no, I'm just trying to help, you know?
Yeah, it's like cleansing the database, you know? It's like you find something obviously fake, something that's obviously been, you know, like you said, I'm sure many enthusiasts, the moment they see that, they're going to say, that Bigfoot looks familiar. Yeah, that's at the International Cryptozoology Museum. I mean, I was just posing with it a couple weeks ago when I was there. Like, it's obvious. And then it'd be so frustrating trying to get, you know, people to kind of be like, okay, get back off. Like, this is a lost cause. I mean, this is something that's obviously fake, but people are resistant to that. And that kind of goes along with what I was saying earlier, that these stories will blow up and then the mainstream media will pick up on them and they'll say, oh, this happened, that happened. And then people who are not even interested in the subject will see it. And then if something happens down the road where it's proven false, you know, in the case of something like that, obviously it would be, people will see that and they'll say, oh yeah, well that just means that all this stuff is phony baloney and it's all, you know, crap and whatever. So that's unfortunate. And then it leaves people like us who are seriously interested in the subject and kind of invested in it saying, well, you know, this is what we're left with, you know, tarnished reputation and having to deal with, frankly, people's kind of ignorance and stupidity in a lot of cases.
I'm not sure if you were following me on Twitter a few months ago when I was posting that Bigfoot warning poster.
Oh, the one about the kind of like the national parks.
Yeah, sort of the one that I inadvertently got wrapped up in creating a giant hoax about.
Oh, no.
I created this poster. I was just bored one day. We're having a slow day at work. I have a graphic design degree. I don't use it often, but I have it. So every once in a while, I just kind of like to do something to keep my skills, you know, just fresh. Remember how to use whatever program I'm using, you know, yada, yada. So I sat down, I made this fake poster.
Amazing.
I made this fake poster, posted it on Facebook, just, you know, as a little joke. I put on there, this is not real. This is just, you know, a piece I made, whatever. Didn't realize it. Someone took it, posted it in all these outdoor groups, and I started having people send it to me. And I'm like, wait a minute, you just got this off my page. They're like, no, this has been shared like, you know, 15,000 times on this page. This has been shared, you know, 7,000 times on this page. And I started contacting all these web, you know, these page managers. And I'm like, hey, I'm just letting you know, I'm the one who created this. This is not real. And the amount of messages I'd get back saying, well, I'm not going to tell people that because that would ruin the joke. And, you know, I'm going to let stupid people think stupid things. Just how mad some of these people got when I was trying to explain that, you know, what you're doing, you're spreading false information, just, you know, giving you a heads up. And even some local investigators in the state started getting this too. And later on, I talked to them and they're like, yeah, do you know about this? I'm like, I'm sorry, man. I'm the one who created this. This is not real. I have the actual one at my house if you want to see it. Like, I still have the files for it. And it's like, you know, once the fire's on, there's no way of putting it out.
Except it had life of its own. But at the same time, that then is an interesting sort of case study where you can direct, you know, it's not like you intended on creating this hoax, right? It was, like you said, you were just kind of bored and you created something fun. And, you know, most people would appreciate that as opposed to, you know, purposely trying to mislead your entire community, which I'm sure there are people, you know, many people do, obviously the hoaxers. But it's an interesting case study because you can say, look, this is something that was obviously fake and it kind of regardless took off in a life of its own. And it's a case study to be able to look into cryptozoology and say, okay, well, this is a phenomenon that happens. And, you know, this is what the social media kind of world enables, you know, like, you know, you could be away from your phone for like an hour and this thing could go viral. And then the damage control, you know, what can you do at that point?
Yeah, it's crazy how fast things spread now. And if you're not like on, you know, ready to go to clarify why you did things, like it's easy to just get taken down by it. And just it, when the DNR commented on it, the state DNR, and I was just like, oh man, this is seriously getting out of hand.
Right. Right. Well, that's something, that's a story to tell
for sure.
Yeah.
So, I know you saw it. I believe you commented on it. I can't remember exactly what you commented because there was tons of comments. But, you know, Lauren Coleman just put out that question he asked about which has more staying power, you know, Bigfoot or Mothman. What do you prefer? Stuff like that. What's your answer on that? I'm just curious.
Sure. So I answered, I personally like cryptids like Mothman more. That was my personal kind of thing. I just think I like the more unique cases, but I said that ultimately Bigfoot is going to win out, you know, hands down against like a Mothman or a Dover Demon or anything like that, simply because I think Bigfoot is so universally known. I mean, it's like the world's most famous public domain character. You know, there's not like a trademark or a copyright, so nobody can, you know, like a Mickey Mouse, nobody can put a stamp on it and say like, you can't do this without paying royalties. So it's interesting because then that creates so many different depictions of what it could look like, which is kind of cool. And it's a cross-cultural because you've got, you know, the Yeti, the Abominable Snowman, the stuff in China, the Yowie, the Yeren, the Sasquatch, the Skunk Ape, the Grassman, Bigfoot, the list goes on and on and on. So it's geographically accessible because, you know, that you could live in any of the 50 states, I guess, aside from Hawaii. And you could have people telling you, yeah, there's Bigfoot in this state, so you could get out there. Whereas something like Mothman, you kind of have to go to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, or I guess, you know, Chicago or some of these other areas that are having these sightings or whatever. I really don't know much about that, but I know that's been sort of a recent phenomena. But, you know, the geography is against things like Champ and Dover Demon and the Mothman and, you know, whatever else the other cases there may be, which is kind of cool in its own sense, because like I said, it creates more of a unique situation where you have to go to these places. You can't just go anywhere. You know, Bigfoot's kind of all over the place and you can do it wherever, as opposed to, right, you know, to a specific place like Loch Ness or wherever the case may be. So, you know, but the geography is against it. That's why I think, you know, like I said, ultimately Bigfoot wins out over the more unique guys.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Bigfoot has that staying power because it's got so much history that was first grounded in reality, which has slowly, you know, evolved into, you know, a little bit of the weirder fringe aspects of it. Whereas Mothman pretty much was thrown directly into that fringe side, that blend of crypto, you know, super paranormal. So it's a very niche cryptid to get into. Depending on who you talk to, Bigfoot can do the same thing. I don't buy into any of that. But yeah, ultimately when it comes down to it, Bigfoot has the staying power.
Yeah.
But internet wise, Mothman takes the cake on it. There has been something as of late, I don't know what it is, but Mothman has become the poster child for cryptozoology on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's almost like a very Americana kind of thing. Whereas Bigfoot, I guess you could argue, like I said, is cross-cultural. I mean, the first sort of awareness of any of these kind of creatures started with the Abominable Snowman and the Yeti. It wasn't until later when, you know, Sasquatch, Bigfoot sort of thing came in. Whereas I think Mothman is, it's that classic West Virginia story. Now you got the fallout thing going on, which is huge. I mean, that's going to bring a lot of people who are not aware of this into that. And I'm sure that's going to bring a lot of people into just cryptozoology more broadly. And like you said, because it is, you know, this crypto paranormal junction, it's like a high strangeness type thing. there's plenty of UFO and, you know, ghost people who are into that as well, because those communities are obviously much larger than cryptozoology. So more people are kind of aware of that. But it's, you know, and it's one of these unique cases. Like I said, I think it's going to have that power to, you know, just continue being unique. And it's connected and immortalized with, you know, the bridge situation there in West Virginia and Point Pleasant and the movie and all the things that are going on about it. So, you know, it, Bigfoot will outlive the internet, so to speak. But Mothman, yeah, you're right. It's definitely kind of the poster child of cryptozoology at the moment.
And I'm cool with that. You know, Mothman could do its own thing because it's been weird to begin with. Like, also like the Flatwoods Monster. It's kind of like, keep doing what you're doing with that. I just don't want anyone to touch my lake monsters. those are my favorite. It's like, let them be creepy, scary, mysterious underwater things, but keep them grounded in reality.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, Lake Champ is one of my favorite cryptids, and just the lake monsters in general. And there's something about water that's so alluring, that's so creepy. You know, I often do a lot of the Bigfoot stuff in New England as well, just because there's, like I said, it's accessibility. You know, I'm able to talk to people in the different states who are in research groups, who have sightings, this and that. So, you know, you kind of get, it's interesting, but with something like Champ, it's, you know, it's under the water. So it's like completely out of your control. It's something that is, you know, I think, you know, I hope at some point we might find some lake monster somewhere, you know, whatever it may be. But, you know, it's that classic like Jaws kind of thing. You're scared of the water, because the water is something that the human psyche still hasn't ever really been able to get over. And it's just mysterious to begin with.
Yeah, because it's like you can't control water. You know, you can feel comfortable containing it, but one little thing goes wrong and, you know, the water's going to end you. And now throw in something could be living in there that makes it that much more dangerous. It's just, it's that fear is always there. Like every time I go up, you know, swimming in a lake or anything, as soon as I jump in, I always get the same thought, what's swimming underneath me? What would I do if a head broke the surface right next to me and then just disappeared? It's always that fear. And when I had what I call, you know, a sighting of, you know, a sea monster, that's the best I can call it, because we have no idea what it was. Like, that fear was real and it was intense. And it's one of those things, like, once it happens, it sticks with you, and then that's what you want to keep looking into. Like, you're drawn to, I got to keep researching this. I got to keep looking at it, because I got to figure out what it was. So if that gets, like, changed for, like, the pop culture new cryptid poster child, it's going to hurt a little bit. It's going to hurt a little bit.
Right, yeah. We like our lake monsters being, and sea monsters being a little bit more low-key. I'll still, you know, obviously Loch Ness Monster is, you know, one of the poster children, aside with Sasquatch, of cryptozoology in general. But, you know, what I was going to say was just the water in general. It's so creepy. I mean, even with known animals, I mean, something I'm really interested too is in great white sharks. You know, they're just like these apex predators. I mean, really interesting creatures. Recently, the past couple of years, Cape Cod, Massachusetts has become like a big hotspot for great whites. And there was a deadly attack just a couple weeks ago that happened.
Seeing that online.
Yeah, it became a big story worldwide. It was the first deadly attack since like the 1930s. And it was the second great white attack this summer season, which is, you know, very unprecedented. And I, you know, like I said, I'm in New England, so I'm kind of geographically able to get there. And last Friday after work, I just kind of drove down to Cape Cod for a little bit. Went on the peninsula there and was just talking to people, trying to see if I could find areas where there were sharks. And I'd go to beaches where there were sharks had been sighted and there were flags up. And, you know, I went to the very beach where the guy was killed, which was a little surreal, you know, where he had unfortunately, you know, bled out and died. He was a young guy. He was like a year older than me. He was like 26. So that was kind of freaky, but I got to talk to a guy who had seen it happen. It was a surfer. And, you know, as we're there, I'm interviewing him and I, I'm working on a little short piece about that, which I'm going to put out pretty soon here. It was just very cool seeing seals just swimming by in the waves because the water was very murky that day. And I was flying my drone over it, trying to see if I could spot any sharks. And you'd see these seals going by, and you know that the sharks are in there because they hunt the seals and they kind of hide in the deeper channels on the beaches.
Right.
And when there's seals, there's sharks. And the reason why there's been the shark explosion in Cape Cod in general is because they haven't been culling the seals since the 70s. So the population has exploded with that. The sharks have come. But like I said, it was so creepy knowing that there was almost certainly great whites swimming in there, but they just weren't coming out, you know, for whatever reason. And it's very creepy feeling because it's like it's so out of your control. It's right there, but you know it's a different world than the one you're standing in on the beach. You know, it's something that's totally alien and totally foreign to humans. So
right. And I think what you just said, you know, that image of the seals swimming around, you know, they don't know the sharks are there. But we know the sharks are there, which is why, you know, we know what's out there, so we're gonna go in. So we create these things that essentially make us the seal, you know, and that's like where a lot of the fear comes from. We're swimming around in a lake. We're swimming around in a river. We don't know what's down there. We have no idea what could be down there. And that's what starts bringing the terror, is that unknown. Like, we know what sharks are. We know what alligators are. We're taking the risk when we go in there. But just that idea that something big, something, you know, 20, 30, 40 feet long could just be hanging out, just watching you swim at the surface. And it's just creepy, but it's exciting at the same time.
Oh, yeah. I love it. I mean, classic, like I said, Jaws feeling, that the mystery. And, you know, that's something that I think universally with this entire subject matter, it's, you know, it's something that's kind of like sexy. Something that's out of our reach, whether it's, you know, Mothman, Bigfoot, whatever the case may be, it's something unknown, especially in this world that we're like increasingly encroached by technology and, you know, kind of the craziness of the world around us. This is almost like an escape. It's like there's still adventure left in the world, and cryptids and cryptozoology are a venue for that. And, you know, something I always say to people is, even if it's all BS, you know, to the people who shut it all down, you'll say, oh, it's all just garbage. You know, so what? Even if it is, it's folklore. You know, you're talking about stories and history within local regions. And to me, that's really cool. And, you know, talking to the people who believe that they have seen things. And that for me, I think is one of the biggest draws to the field in general.
Oh, same here. I think that's why one of the main reasons I got into this, and, you know, I've told some people this before, but it's like, you know, it's kind of a shock to hear when people ask what I believe in cryptozoology about cryptids, 90% I don't believe in. It's just, right. I can't, you know, I think rationally, I think scientifically, if there's a problem, I want to get to the bottom of it, you know, and then in doing so, you're going to find out that what you thought was a monster is just something that can easily be explained. The reason I like to do this is because I like essentially preserving these stories, because the stories are just fun. They're, like you said, it's just that draw to them. It's, hey, this area we're in, did you know that at one point such and such happened to this person? This thing was seen by this person. It's like, oh, that's cool. I didn't know that was here in my own backyard. It's like, yeah, it's... the history surrounding you is what draws me to do this. I like telling people that. I like the looks on their faces. Like if I talk to kids or if I talk to friends and, you know, their eyes light up, it's like, seriously, a monster? It's like, yeah, what, you were just swimming and people say that there's a monster in there, you know, and then you tell the story and it's like, wow, I never knew that. And it's like, that's why I like doing it. I like hearing people, they learn something new.
I couldn't agree more. I think you're doing a great job with your website. Like I said, I love the way it looks and everything. And I couldn't agree more. As a filmmaker, you know, I'm a storyteller, and I like preserving these stories and, you know, visualizing them and giving people sort of a visual representation of what they've seen and just, you know, getting their story out there. And that for me is one of the biggest things. And, yeah, it's a lot of fun. Just, you know, keep up the good work. And, I think we're going to keep riding this wave of resurgence for a little bit now, and hopefully that leads to more you know, maybe TV programs and documentary, sure. Just keep, you know, actually treating the subject legitimately and not as a kind of reality show spectacle.
Exactly. Same, you know, same for you, man. Like I told you when we started, you know, me and my oldest were watching, you know, we're watching Champ, and I like to look at the kids when we're watching this stuff. We just watched Beast of Bray Road the other day, and I like watching them watch it more than me, because to see, like, because I know the stories about them, so I know what's coming, like the depictions of which will show up on screen, and to see like their eyes like get big, and then they have to ask, like, is that real? And it's like, that's what people say.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I can't say if it is or it isn't. And it's just that wow factor. And to know that, you know, they might get interested to the point where they want to get involved in the sciences, and maybe they make a breakthrough of it. You know, it's awesome to think that you're a part of this, what's this up and coming, you know, change in the field. It's just very cool to be a part of. Did we lose each other? Oh, yeah, I think we lost each other. If we did, this was a very good conversation, clocking in at an hour and 26 minutes.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay. Oh, I just to close it out, I got to get going here.
Oh, no problem.
But just to close it out, kind of, you know, one of these cool things, you can hear me, right?
Yep, I can hear you.
Great. You know, one of the things I often encounter when I meet like younger people at the conferences is they kind of are like, oh, it's so cool. Like, because, you know, I'm a millennial, I'm a younger guy, you know, I'm into this stuff. And like, oh, you know, most of the time it's, you know, older people in this field, you know, whichever paranormal kind of area, just because they're the ones that have had the experience. But, you know, we're the generation that's kind of going to take it over. And I really like talking to the kids and telling them like, hey, it's just fun to get out there, like, especially in this day and age, you know, with the cell phones and all the technology and all the distractions, it's like, just go out in the woods. Like, even if you're, you know, hunting Bigfoot, like, just have fun, go hike around, you know, just get outdoors and really have fun with it. And, you know, I think it's cool. I was passed down a big collection of Bigfoot tracks from, you know, the 90s that the friend of mine who had, you know, kind of done research in the field had, you know, hung out with people like John Green and other folks out in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
Was given these tracks, you know, like Peter Byrne tracks and John Green, some of these footprints. And I've been copying them recently. And I'm just like, I hope to get to some point, you know, one day down the road where there's some other, you know, because what happened was I contacted this guy and he was like, hey, you know, I'd love to pass this kind of stuff and this research down to somebody. And, you know, I'd love to be at a point some, you know, down the road where I'm able to, you know, get like whether it's my own kids or, you know, someone else who's a young up and comer kind of getting interested in it and be able to pass them down sort of a legacy of you know, this history that dates back from the 60s and even further. And I think that's really cool.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me on, man. It was a really, really insightful conversation. I loved the back and forth there with all the cryptid stuff. And obviously, you know, your stuff. So
keep, yeah, it was definitely a fantastic conversation. I'm glad that, you know, you were able to do it. Like I said, I'm not doing anything like professional or polished or anything. I'm just, people want to talk, I want to talk to them and, you know, put it out there. If people want to listen, awesome. Maybe they'll learn something. It's definitely just a fun time to talk to other people who are passionate and into it.
Yeah. I feel like sometimes like the interviews I've done, you know, it's all questions and it's all more formal or you're promoting like a certain project. Whereas I like this where we can just kind of literally talk about Champ and end up, you know, Great Whites or, you know, Iceland, whatever the case may be. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah, so it evolves into its own thing. Where it wants to go, it's going to go.
Yeah, that's like that podcast kind of format.
Exactly. Well, I definitely hope we can do it again. We need to set up another time sometime and go over a bunch of other handful of topics we were nowhere even close to talking about this time.